Definitely not a secret that today the greater part of the religious world has turned their attention to the resurrection of Jesus. And while you and I may have some different ideas as to how we go about celebrating perhaps one day over another, always try to appreciate the fact that there's something that's making people think about something that they might not otherwise think about. In this case, the resurrection of Jesus. There are a lot of people who are thinking about that, and they may not often do that. And so I appreciate that, and I want to use this as an opportunity to talk about the resurrection of Jesus. And I want to talk about it tonight from the standpoint of evidences. Evidences for our faith. You know the questions that all of us have to wrestle with. Why believe in God? Why believe in Jesus? Why do I believe the Bible is what it says that it is or what it claims to be? Some of us recently were discussing 1 Peter chapter 3, and you get to verse 15, and Peter says there, you need to be ready to give a defense for your faith or for your hope. In other words, Peter is saying you need to be able to articulate why you believe what you believe. Now, I think that has always been important. I mean, Peter wrote that a long time ago. I think it might be incredibly important in the cultural climate that we're in today, where fewer and fewer people have faith in God. We live in a time where no doubt our faith is going to be challenged, and it's going to be brought into question. And so even if we're not called on someone to give a specific answer for why you believe what you believe, I think it's still good that we have this faith just for our own conviction. And so tonight, when we talk about evidences, for some of you, this might just be reinforcing a faith that you've been building and working on and strengthening for a long time. Somebody listening tonight might still be kind of working on their faith. And so for either, I think this will be helpful. I was reading something recently, just last week, where a man a long time ago called Christian Faith nothing more than an illogical belief in the occurrence of the improbable. In other words, he's just saying Christians just believe in a bunch of nonsense. That's essentially what he's saying. And I hope you know there's nothing further from the truth. And our young people, I hope you especially hear this. There is nothing further from the truth. Christian faith is not illogical. It is intelligent faith. It's not some irrational belief. It is not just some blind leap into the dark. As a matter of fact, when it comes to evidence for faith, there's not a short list. As a matter of fact, there are lots of things that we can point to as evidence for our faith, good evidence for it. We can talk about the Bible. We talk about the way it's composed and the way it was written. We can talk about fulfilled prophecy. We can talk about how much evidence there is for it compared to any other historical thing. And we can talk about nature itself. Answering that question, what best explains our existence? Is it that we were here just by chance of some accident or something intentional? And I don't think it's all that hard for us to wrap our minds around that. I think about this podium. It's a new podium to us. Some of you don't know that, but this is new podium to us. And whoever built it has a skill set that I don't possess. I could maybe do something like this, but it would probably would be wobbly and it wouldn't be uniform. It just wouldn't look good. But you recognize that this is not something very complex. It's actually pretty simple compared to lots of other things. But even something not complex, you don't look at this and think, well, maybe that just kind of appeared that way. Everybody would look at this reasonably and they would say, well, somebody had to think about this and somebody had to have some intention and somebody had to design it and somebody had to put it all together. And if that's true of something like this podium, how much more is it true of something really intricate, something that is complex like our human bodies or nature and the universe itself? And we could just keep adding to that list. We could talk about the finds in archaeology, and we could talk about the very fact that morals exist. I think that says there is a God. But to that list of proofs, we need to have on it the resurrection of Jesus. I call this proof positive, not necessarily because I think it is the proof of all proofs, But I do think it could top the list for different reasons. For one, there are lots of evidences for the resurrection outside the Bible. There are lots of proofs for the resurrection outside the Bible. Now, I'm not being dismissive of the Scriptures. I believe there's incredible proof for the Bible to be what it claims to be. And if the Bible is what it claims to be, then I don't need anything outside of the Bible. The Bible itself is enough. But I do think any time we have something outside of the Bible that supports what the Bible teaches, I think that can be helpful for our faith. I also think it can be helpful if we're dealing with someone who's a skeptic. Because if I keep going to you and say, well, the Bible says this and the Bible says this, but they don't even believe that the Bible is the Word of God, then I'm not going to get very far with them. There may be somebody here tonight who listens, or somebody who listens is who's not convinced that the Bible is what it claims to be. Well, just know, I think we can have certainty about the resurrection of Jesus just from a historical standpoint. And that is really important. I want you to think about it this way. Thinking about the passage that was just read in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Paul kind of frames it this way, that if Jesus didn't come back from the dead, then Jesus is not really who he said to be or who he claimed to be. Jesus is essentially a fraud if he didn't come out of the grave. Jesus on multiple occasions would say, for instance, in Matthew chapter 16 and verse 21, Jesus would say, it is necessary for me to go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed and raised on the third day. And so the way that Paul is framing it is that if Jesus was not raised from the dead, then we can all go home and just do whatever we want to. We can just go live out the rest of our days and not worry about it if Jesus hasn't been raised from the dead. The way that Paul talks about the resurrection is that the resurrection is everything to our faith. If Jesus was raised from the dead, that changes everything. Now Jesus is who he says that he is, or who he claimed to be. And we can place our trust in whatever Jesus says. And so it is almost as if the resurrection, our faith kind of hinges on the resurrection. And if we can get it figured out, then that's going to allow a lot of other things to fall into place. And if I can get the resurrection figured out, I have more than sufficient reason to put my faith in God, and to put my faith in Jesus, and to put my faith in the words of God. That might mean I have some other things to kind of figure out along the way, but if I can figure out the resurrection, I have enough reason to put my faith in God. Now, I mentioned outside the Bible evidence, and I think that that is helpful when we're thinking about the resurrection, the fact that it is supported by extra-biblical sources. I think that is important because you have people, and I have the word historical underlined there. That is important because there are lots of people who don't care anything about theology. They don't have any skin in the game when it comes to what's right or what's wrong religiously. They're just historians. And so I think it is important for us to know that there is a lot of historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. But to kind of add some strength to that, there's a lot of support by independent historical sources. So you've got historical sources. They may or may not be believers. They may or may not be Christians. But you definitely have some who are completely independent. And again, I think that is important. Not because somebody with bias can't necessarily be trusted to tell the truth. I think we trust biased sources all the time. I think about maybe your favorite sports team. Maybe it's Alabama or Auburn or something else. But there are the beat writers. They write for their team. And most of them are biased. That's the team that they pull for. That's the team that they hope win. Well, think about this on a Saturday. Think about this team. They travel and they go on the road and they just get slaughtered. Well, the beat writer is supposed to write about the game. And he is maybe upset that they lost. And he's definitely biased, but that does not mean that he doesn't possess the ability to just write, this is what happened. Do you see the point? And so it's not as if someone biased can't be trusted, but if we can have independent historical sources, I think that strengthens the argument even more. And here's maybe the most powerful thing. When we're just looking at extra-biblical sources, I think one of the most powerful things is that there is evidence that for the resurrection that is supported even by people who are enemies, people who are hostile. There are people who despise the idea of Christianity, but even they have to admit some historical claims that support the resurrection. And so this is some of why I said in the beginning the resurrection can really be really kind of near the top of our list of evidences just because there's so much evidence for it, and it's not just biblical evidence, it's historical evidence, and it's historical evidence by people who are independent, and it's also historical evidence by people who are actually even opposed to it. So there are two gentlemen by the name of one man, Gary Habermas, the other, Michael Lacona. And they are both thought of as resurrection scholars. That's how much time they have spent searching, researching the resurrection. They're resurrection scholars. And I will just tell you, if you want a source that lays out all of the arguments and it lays out all of the details, then I can recommend that book. It gets a lot deeper than what we're going to get tonight. But it's called The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus. The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus. And they go incredibly deep into a lot of things. But one approach that they take is called the minimal facts approach. And the minimal facts approach is that we're only going to use data that there is the strongest evidence for, and only the data that's granted by even skeptical scholars. This is kind of a way of them saying there is a lot of evidence out there, but we'll take the bare minimum and prove the resurrection, even if you'll just give me the bare minimum. That's kind of the approach that is in this book. And we'll kind of work with that a little bit tonight. Not necessarily stay with that strictly, but we'll kind of work with that a little bit. I'll give you an example of this minimal facts. One example of that is the book of 1 Corinthians, or Paul's first letter to the Corinthians that we have in our New Testament. 1 Corinthians is hard to deny, and it becomes an incredible piece of evidence for the resurrection because historically, you cannot dispute that Paul was real and that Paul's story was real. Again, historically, it can be proven that Paul was a Jew, one who persecuted Christians, one who was adamantly opposed to Christianity. Yet he also then became an apostle of Jesus Christ. Historically, there's tons of evidence for that. And there's lots and lots of evidence that Paul, the same Paul, wrote that letter to those Christians in Corinth. And there's also incredible evidence showing that letter was written probably 25 years or sooner than within, or 25 years within the date of the event itself. And so this is just historically speaking. You can't deny Paul. You can't deny 1 Corinthians. And you cannot deny that it was written within about a 25 or less year time frame from the event, the actual event. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody then just naturally believes in the inspiration of Scripture. But what it does say is that there is incredible evidence that supports the resurrection outside of the Bible. One scholar says this is the sort of data that historians of antiquity drool over. This kind of data. Paul, Corinthian letter, 25 years within the actual date of the event, you realize historically that is unprecedented. There's nothing that compares to that when we start digging back deeply into history. And so let me just kind of run through some of those minimal facts with you. Here's the first one, that Jesus died by crucifixion. That is just not even disputed. Nobody of any legitimacy denies the fact that Jesus was a real person and that he was from Nazareth and all the stuff about Jesus. And I say legitimate, and I use the word scholars because I'm very aware there are some YouTube atheists out there who are just taking shots at Christianity. And they say lots of things they don't even really have the credentials to listen to them anyway. But when you start looking back into history, nobody of any reputation denies Jesus as a real person. And nobody is able to deny that Jesus died by crucifixion. He died by the hands of the Jews and the Romans and by Pilate. That's not deniable by historical standards. And so that's the first fact. The second is that his disciples believed that he arose and appeared to them. Again, that's historically documented. And if that's historically accurate, then we got to start digging deeply to figure out why. Why did his disciples believe that they saw Jesus after being crucified on the cross and being buried in the tomb? And then the fact that of Paul, I've already mentioned Paul. And it's historically undeniable that Paul was suddenly changed. By Paul's own admission, he was the Jew of Jews. By Paul's own admission, he breathed threats to those who were practicing Christianity. And by his own admission, it was seeing the resurrected Jesus that made him change instantly. And so you have to start thinking, well, what would cause someone like Paul to make such a sudden change? James, the brother of Jesus, was suddenly changed. This one doesn't get as much talk just because Paul is more well-known than James. But you might remember from the Gospels that the very family of Jesus was skeptical of him. There were times where they almost kind of ridiculed him. There was one occasion where they came to get Jesus and take him home because they thought maybe he's kind of lost his mind. He's kind of gone crazy. They're hearing lots of things that people are saying about Jesus, and they had a legitimate concern. But there's lots telling us that the very brothers of Jesus were not believers in him as the Messiah. Yet both biblically and extra-biblical sources will tell us that James, the brother of Jesus, became a very central figure in the early Christian church. And then there's this. There's the empty tomb. And Habermas actually leaves this off of the minimal facts list. It's almost as if he gives the empty tomb honorable mention. In his book, he actually listed four plus here's another one. And the reason that he does it like that is because there are a few scholars who won't grant the empty tomb, although there's strong evidence for it, and it is accepted by an impressive majority. But again, keep in mind, he's just saying, I'll prove it using only the bare minimum of facts. But the empty tomb is so widely accepted that I think it has to enter into the discussion. Now, the facts alone don't prove that Jesus was resurrected. I mean, just if you look at any one by themselves, or if you just looked at all of them, because you and I might look at this and say, well, the tomb was empty, and Paul was changed drastically, and James was changed drastically, and we know Jesus died by crucifixion, and we know there were lots of people who saw Jesus alive.
So you and I might look at those facts and say, well, the only conclusion is that Jesus was raised from the dead. Not everybody draws that conclusion. Some people look at those facts and they say, well, there's got to be some other explanation. And so you start coming up with alternative theories. If I don't believe that Jesus was raised from the dead, then these facts are maybe telling me something different. And so here come the alternative theories. I'll share a couple of those with you. But before I do, here's what you have to have in mind. When you start weighing the evidence, when you start looking at the alternative theories, you have to take into account all the facts or all of the testimony. In other words, an alternative theory is useless if it doesn't answer to all the testimony. For instance, I'll mention this one at the end. Hallucination. Some people say that these eyewitness sightings of Jesus after His death, some people would just say, well, they were just hallucinating. Well, there are lots of problems with that, but guess what hallucination doesn't answer to? Hallucination does nothing to answer for the empty tomb. And hallucination does nothing to answer for Paul, because Paul was seen or saw Jesus much later than the others. Do you see the point? When we're starting to wade through, all right, what are the other theories? If a theory doesn't answer to all the facts, then it can't be a legitimate theory. So I just wanted to, for the rest of our time, take you through some of those theories. The first one I'll spend more time on. The others I'll just mention, and I don't really have much to say about them, because I think what you'll see is these theories are not very strong at all, and they just don't even warrant much discussion. But here's the first one. Is that the apostles just lied. They just kind of made the whole thing up. And maybe that would kind of make sense, right? Out of embarrassment, we met this man. He told us his name was Jesus. He claimed to be from God. He did some incredibly powerful things. And so we started latching on to him, and we started following him, and we had pinned all of our hopes on him. This kind of reminds me of those two men on the road to Emmaus. You remember Jesus appeared to them. They didn't know it was Jesus. And they're telling him, man, how do you not know what just happened? But it is a story of being dejected, because here they thought this is going to be the long-awaited Messiah, and then he died on the cross. That was the thinking. Is that he just died. And that was the end of him. And so you can imagine, certainly, if that were the case, there's going to be some people embarrassed. And so the theory is, well, maybe out of embarrassment, these disciples, the apostles specifically, just made up the fact that they saw Jesus. Well, there are a few problems with that. One of the problems is that historically, none of them ever abandoned that story. That's pretty impressive when you understand how human nature typically works. Because if they knew the resurrected Jesus, the sightings of Jesus, was a lie, now we somehow have to be convinced that at a bare minimum, 12 men put their heads together, made up the story, and they all held it together, despite all the terrible things that happened to them, even all the way until their death. When we're looking at historical things, you have to deal in probability. What's the probability that 12 men came up with a conspiracy theory and none of them ever caved? Katie and I, just the other night, were watching. It was a Dateline or a 48 Hours, but it was a real-life murder mystery, and they're trying to get to the bottom of it. And it really just kind of boiled down to about three people who were kind of in the know. And you know what had happened by the end of the episode? All three people involved had changed their story. Why? Well, if I change my story, I may change it if it means something a little bit more favorable for me. And that's just one example. You think about all of the conspiracies and the things that have gone on in the political world. It's just not reasonable to think that people went all the way to their death holding on to what they knew to be a lie. You might say, well, there have been lots of people who died for a lie. People who died for something that's not true. And I would agree, but here's the difference. They didn't know it wasn't true. You and I in our lifetime have seen acts of terrorism. We have seen Muslims, for the sake of Islam, strap a bomb onto their chest and go into a crowd of people and they'll blow themselves up. And they're doing it for the sake of their religion. And they firmly believe that they're doing it for something that is true. But it's not that they have seen it firsthand and know it's true. They are acting on faith. They're only acting on what has been passed down. That is not the case with the apostles. If Jesus was, the resurrection of Jesus was just a made-up story, they would have known it was a made-up story. And people are not willing to die for what they know is a lie. If they knew that Jesus was dead, Jesus would have lost all meaning to them. There's no reason, outside of maybe saving face, there's no reason to concoct a story about seeing Jesus resurrected. And I feel like I could say a lot more about this, about in their time, the idea of the resurrection was just a crazy idea. You think about Paul, he gets there in Acts chapter 17 and he starts talking to people who love to hear all the new things. And as soon as he said the resurrection, he's like, well, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. And so the fact that they made up the story with no good reason doesn't make any sense. The fact that they made up that story wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. But not only does it not make sense because they didn't have anything to gain. Now, somebody might lie if there's something to gain. If you can become powerful, maybe you'll tell a lie for that. If you can become wealthy or popular, maybe you'd live out a lie for that. But guess what? None of the apostles gained. None of them gained power. None of them gained popularity. And none of them gained financially. It just didn't happen. They had zero motivation to make up the story and take that story to their grave. But not only do we have to come to terms with the impossibility that they held the conspiracy together and they died for what they would have known to be a lie, how did the story get any traction? Think about that with me for a minute. So they made up a story. Jesus, yes, He died on the cross. He went in the tomb. But He was resurrected. Now, how did that story get any traction? One writer commented that the testimony of the resurrection was presented in the teeth of opposition. I like that phrase. The apostles are telling about the resurrection of Jesus in the teeth of opposition. He goes on to say that among hostile cross-examiners who would have certainly destroyed the case for Christianity had the facts been otherwise. In other words, all he's saying is these people are telling a story, and if the story could have been proven wrong, it would have been shredded to pieces right there on the spot. Because they're telling the story. If you believe the book of Acts, in Acts chapter 2, within 50 days of the resurrected Jesus, they're in Jerusalem and they're saying Jesus was resurrected. And he says, we're all witnesses to that. Now, if that had not been true, if that could have been proven wrong, where would have been the best time and place to prove it wrong? In Jerusalem, in the very time that it happened. So think about Jerusalem is the least likely place, and that's the least likely time this story could have gained any traction at all. I want you to think for a minute about 9/11/2001. I mention that regularly, but that's because that's an impact event in our lives. If you were more than just a few years old, you remember something about 9/11/2001. You remember things because it was an impact event. If I were to just give you some other random date in history, like June 2nd, 2019. Now, unless I just randomly guessed your birthday or an anniversary, nobody really knows what happened on that day, right? Don't embarrass me here. If you know something, tell me later. You don't remember what was on the news that day. You don't remember maybe where you were. You don't remember the kinds of conversations you had on that day. Although that day is way more recent to us than some date all the way back in September of 2001. And that stands to us as a great example of how powerful impact events are. It also shows us how impossible it would be to create some kind of hoax in the very time in which it happened. We're in almost an identical situation with 9/11 that the people were in when Paul was writing 1 Corinthians all the way back in about AD 55. Because again, historically, it can be proven that Paul was writing about the resurrection 25 years or less from the event. We are in that same window of time with 9/11. So you tell me, we're in that window of time. What are the chances that I could create some kind of conspiracy or hoax and convince a whole lot of people that 9/11 didn't happen? Do you think there's going to be any chance of success with me getting that story off the ground, trying to convince you 9/11 didn't happen? It was a hoax. It was a conspiracy. It just didn't happen. And you know why I'm not going to be able to get any legs under that. Because there are witnesses to it who are still alive today. That story could easily be refuted now. Now, maybe in a few hundred years, maybe there's a chance, but not now. And the same is true with the apostles and the resurrection of Jesus. 50 days after the resurrection, in the very place where it happened. You see, if it could have been proven wrong, that would have been the time and the place. And guess what? If you could prove the empty tomb wrong, guess how long Christianity would have lasted? It would have stopped on the spot. So it's easy to just say, you know what, that's a made up story. But there are lots and lots of things that you cannot answer if you say it's just a made up story. All right, don't get scared. I'm going to move through the rest of these pretty quick, because they really just don't make sense. I don't even know how many people actually believe that the body was stolen. So that would explain the empty tomb. But what about all those precautions between the Romans and the Jews? Because remember, Jesus had said, on the third day I'll raise up. They knew that, and so what did they do? Well, let's put some extra security there because we don't want this story going anywhere. And so this would require the apostles somehow to be able to remove the body of Jesus without the Roman guards knowing. And what would they say? They say, well, it happened while we were asleep. Well, if you were asleep, how do you know what happened? You understand, there's just not any legitimacy to a story like this. It also doesn't explain some real radical changes by somebody like Paul or James. You see, you can say, well, the body was stolen, but that leaves a whole lot of questions unanswered. And here's maybe one of the favorites. I mentioned this earlier. They were delusional, or they were hallucinating. Well, this doesn't explain the empty tomb. And you realize the Jewish authorities, the Roman authorities, had every incentive to produce the body. Again, all they had to do was show up. And Peter's standing there in Jerusalem saying, Jesus was resurrected from the dead. His tomb is empty. All they would have had to do is say, nope, not true. They had every incentive to do so, and they were unable to do it. Now, hallucination is a real thing. People do hallucinate, especially in moments of grief and high anxiety. I mean, I don't know if any of you have ever actually hallucinated or not, but we all know how our minds can do some crazy things. Just think about dreams. Maybe some of you dream like I do. Sometimes you dream some crazy things. It was probably about a month ago, I dreamed that me and Jacob, Katie, and Brock Romine went into a Birmingham area congregation and we broke into their church building. I have no idea why we did that. I don't know what we were thinking. I'm assuming they talked me into it. And I kid you not, I woke up scared to death that Jim was going to find out. And he was going to be really upset with me. And I have confirmed he would have been upset had he got a phone call from some elders in Birmingham saying, guess what Jared and Jacob were doing. And so if I ever do that, I can't claim ignorance. You see, our minds do have the ability to do crazy things. And hallucinations are possible. But remember, Paul says that Jesus appeared to over 500 people at one time, and guess what does not happen? Not even two people hallucinate the same exact thing. 500's not even a possibility. And again, that doesn't explain Paul's radical change either. Here's the last one. Jesus was buried alive. He only appeared to be dead. Somehow, he survived the beating and the crucifixion, and without any medical care of any kind, Jesus is somehow able to roll the stone away and get past the guards. Anybody need me to elaborate a whole lot more on that one? I mean, Jim this morning talked about Romans and crucifixions. Is it safe to say they were professionals at what they did? And do you really think Pilate, who's really, really concerned about getting in hot water and losing his job, do you really think he's going to just kind of haphazardly get somebody down off the cross and bury him if he doesn't have absolute certainty that they're dead? Do you think the Romans were in the habit of botching crucifixions? I mean, Jim talked this morning about they may even hasten the death by stabbing or building fires under them. And so to think somehow that Jesus was just in a state of unconsciousness and had all of those people duped, and then yet still somehow came out of the tomb despite the guards, is just not even reasonable. And so here's what I want to leave you with tonight. What best explains that? Because remember, I said in historical inquiry, professional historians work in terms of strength of probability. What are the chances? And so then we're left to wrestle with what explains the empty tomb. And what explains the radical transformations, not just the apostles, but all the people who are latching on to Christianity and they're leaving Judaism behind. What would explain apostles one day telling Jesus, "Jesus, you tell me you're going to die, you're wrong about that," and then just not long later they're preaching, "Jesus died and He was resurrected"? What would explain that? What would explain those sacrificial deaths of the apostles? And what would explain the eyewitness sightings and the rapid growth of the church in Jerusalem of all places? What would explain the fact that the body was never produced? And that's the only thing it would have taken. Produce the body, Christianity would have died on the spot. What best explains that? And then the last one. You realize that there were lots of people who claimed to be the Messiah. And they may have had good stories. They may have had stories that resembled the story of Jesus. And they may have had a pretty big following. I mean, we know of people who rose up and had people follow them. So, of all the imposters, why does Jesus' story still live on over all the rest? And the answer is because none of those men survived and lived or came back from their death. All of those men died like Jesus. Jesus is the only one that came back. So, I'll leave you with this thought. If you're still skeptical, why? Why is the, not just the resurrection, but why is the Bible itself so heavily disputed when it has unsurpassed evidence? Why do people easily believe lots of other historical facts, even though there's not a whole lot of evidence for it? Why do people so easily say, yes, that was true? Bible, no, that can't be true. And I think you know the answer to that. The answer is because the Bible and the resurrection has implications with it. You see, there are lots of historical facts that I can choose to accept or choose to deny without any consequence at all. I mean, I could debate heavily whether George Washington was a real person or not. And the conclusion that you and I come to after that debate really doesn't have any bearing on life, does it? But that's not true with Jesus. If Jesus was raised from the dead, there are major implications. And I'm afraid a lot of people reject the evidence because they don't like the implications. I hope that's not anybody listening to this, but I do think that is the reality. Let me end with something encouraging. Jacob read this before, the call to worship. But in that 1 Corinthians 15 where Paul says our faith hinges on the resurrection, he says in the end there, verse 58, you can have great confidence that your work in the Lord is not in vain. If you are serving God, I want you to know, because the resurrection of Jesus, you are not serving God in vain. You are not wasting your time. And so if you're faithfully serving God, you keep doing that, and you be inspired by the testimony that proves without a doubt Jesus was the Son of God. He died on the cross for my sins, and He was raised up, and He being raised up proves my very own resurrection to come. Now, maybe you've been struggling with your faith. If we can help you with that in any way, you let us know and we'll try to help you with whatever way that we can. Maybe you have never decided to put your faith and your trust in God and in Jesus. Someone this morning decided, I'm going to give my life to God. Maybe someone here tonight wants to do that very same thing. And that would be an incredibly exciting way to end this service, with someone submitting to the waters of baptism for the forgiveness of sins, ready to leave a new person. If that's you, why don't you make that happen tonight? Let's stand and sing.